And welcome back to the second half of this week's episode of Words and Movies. I hope you had a restful break.
I did, and I hope you did as well.
Woo! I am so... You have no idea how relaxed I am now.
Okay, so let's get to it as Claude gives us the plot description for After the Wedding.
Yeah. So, yeah, the first one ended with a wedding. This one begins pretty much with a wedding. Mads Mikkelsen is a Jacob. He's a Danish national who manages an orphanage in India. The orphanage is in deep financial trouble, well, it has been for several years, and he's been working very hard to keep it afloat. We also see just how invested he is in the lives of the children, especially this nearly 8-year-old boy named Pramod, with whom he's practically raised since birth. A Danish corporation has offered a huge donation to the orphanage, but there's a catch. Jacob has to come to Copenhagen to meet with the CEO, Jorgen Hansen, to get the money. Jake is upset by this, but they don't have much alternative, and he agrees to go. He promises Pramod that he'll be back in India in time for his 8th birthday, about a week hence. He explained he doesn't want to stay in Denmark where everyone is rich because rich people generally suck. Pramod posits rather wisely that people live far apart because they're personally far apart. We cut abruptly from dusty, squalid Mumbai to some lush countryside in Denmark. It's Jorgen. He's being driven home to his estate while It's Raining Men is blasting on the car's stereo. We get a little slice of his life as he greets his twin sons and his wife, Helene, and they talk about their daughter's wedding, which is coming up that weekend. We also meet Jorgen's mother, who may be losing her faculties a little bit. Jacob's plane arrives in Copenhagen, and he's met by Jorgen's limo driver, who takes him to a luxurious hotel suite with multiple bathrooms, an open bar, and high-end entertainment equipment. It's really like a really nice one-bedroom apartment more than it is a hotel room, and all of it's being paid for by Jorgen's corporation. And you're getting a real contrast between this and where he was back when he was in Mumbai. Anyway, the next day, Jacob is greeted by Christian, who's to escort him to the office. Christian, it turns out, is the fiancé of Jorgen's daughter, whose name, by the way, is Anna. He wishes Jacob luck, and he is on his way. Jacob meets with Jorgen, who says he's still considering which project to fund, and Jacob's a little surprised because he thought it was already a done deal, but he agrees to be patient. Jorgen invites Jacob to Anna's wedding, knowing he doesn't really have anything else to do. Jacob's ride to the wedding gets hung up behind some farm equipment, and he arrives late to the ceremony, arriving very close to the ending. As he enters, the church door closes rather loudly, and Helene looks back to see who came in. She sees Jacob sit in the back, and there's a concerned look on her face, but we're not clear what she's so worried about. Jacob spies her looking back at him, but he doesn't really react. However, outside, as people are chatting with one another, Jacob says hello to Helene, and she greets him by name, so clearly they know each other. What eventually emerges is that 20 years ago, when they were both in India, he was the love of her life, but he drank a lot, and he slept with her best friend, and they ultimately broke up. She left India, and they each thought that the other would come back, but that never happened. I'm getting a little bit ahead of the story, though. At the reception, Christian stands up, and he makes a speech/toast telling how he first got acquainted with Anna and thanking Jorgen and Helene for taking him in and treating him like family. Shortly thereafter, Anna stands up and makes a speech of her own, noting that Helene is expecting some kind of disaster to happen, and so her speech, which is a break from tradition, is her means of just getting that part over with. Well, Anna says during the speech that she learned early on that Jorgen isn't her biological father, but he never made that distinction as she grew up, raising her as though she were his own child. Helene's eyes get really big, and she looks at Jacob, hoping against hope that he can't do math, but Jacob's already managed to put two and two together, and he walks out of the room, clearly distraught. The next day, he confronts Helene, angry about not being told. She claims that they tried to track him down in India, but they weren't successful, and in fact, they had more or less come to the conclusion that he was dead. Helene has to tell Anna the truth, and of course, she's upset at first. Anna goes to meet Jacob, and it's awkward, but they do get along well. Jorgen says he knew about Jacob and Helene's past, but he didn't realize that this was the same Jacob. But he begins to stall the negotiations that are surrounding the donation to the orphanage, and this gets Jacob a little upset because of his promise to Pramod. They go out to lunch, and Jorgen asks about what it was like getting reacquainted with Helene, and he says he genuinely wants to be a good person, and by now it's clear he's pretty drunk. He calls for more alcohol, but he gets belligerent when they cut him off. He starts talking about the necessity of making difficult decisions in the face of the rules, and it all ends when he drops money on the table, and then he flips the table over and he leaves. When he gets home, he's still drinking. He tells Helene that he wants to have a party to celebrate his upcoming birthday. Helene wonders what's up, why does he want this, and also why won't he let Jacob go home? They get into an argument where, again, he tries to explain his need to be a good person and she should be happy that he cut a deal with Jacob. She leaves the room and he's left with his liquor and the judgment of many taxidermied heads. Jorgen tells Jacob that rather than a short series of annual donations, instead, he would like to fund a foundation in Jacob and Anna's names with a pretty large sum of money. Jacob is confused by this and goes to meet Helene to see what she knows. It gets tense, but it comes down to the fact that she's kind of baffled by Jorgen's actions, too. And by the end of the scene, these two have more or less reconciled. Anna has a conversation with Christian about maybe going to India, but he doesn't want to hear about it. Christian is angry that all she seems to talk about is Jacob, and he's irritated by it. Later, Anna goes to her parents' house and asks Helene if she married Jorgen so that Anna would have a father. Helene says no, she loves Jorgen, but she also kind of wanted to forget about Jacob. Later, an offhand comment by Jorgen's mother has some wheels turning in Helene's head. She goes to the cabinet where Jorgen keeps his medication and examines the bottles. One of them is morphine. The other one we can't see clearly, but Google translates tells me that the directions say it's also for treating severe pain. She calls Jorgen's doctor and learns about his diagnosis of a terminal illness. Not only is he sick, she learns he's been sick for 5 months. Jorgen is angry about this breach of confidentiality, but apparently he had told the doctor that he was going to tell his wife the truth after the wedding. So as far as the doctor was concerned, that wasn't an issue anymore. Jacob is sitting in his hotel room, flashing back on the kids and his promise to Pramod. He calls the orphanage and he tries to explain to Pramod why he's breaking the promise, but the boy isn't having any of it and he cuts the call short. So it turns out that one of the conditions of the contract is that Jacob has to live in Denmark. Jacob realizes that he was targeted for this donation. Jorgen is somehow trying to buy him off and that he has known where Jacob was for a while. He basically saved this knowledge for this moment, and Jacob is so angry that he leaves Jorgen's office. Jorgen runs after Jacob and catches up with him outside, where he breaks down and confesses the truth. He's going to die, and he deliberately brought Jacob to Denmark to take care of Anna and Helene, and even the twin boys after he dies. Jacob is still angry, and now he's a little confused besides, and he heads to his hotel room, leaving Jorgen behind. In the room, he thinks about the kids again and tries to call Anna, but gets her voicemail instead. We see Anna out with some friends. She's having a high old time when she realizes that she needs to get home and, as she puts it, take care of her hubby. She leaves the party and heads back to her apartment. We come back to Jacob in his hotel room, and there's a knock on the door, and it's Anna. She asks if she can stay in the hotel room that night. We learn through a short series of dialogue-free flashbacks that when she got home, Christian was in bed with another woman. She spends the night on the sofa in the hotel room. Gigantic hotel room, only got the one bed. The next morning, Helene comes to the hotel, summoned by Jacob, who's already told her what happened. She consoles Anna as Jacob looks on, pondering and realizing that they might indeed need him in their lives, but also he needs them. He agrees to sign the contract for the foundation funding with all of the conditions intact. Anna comes to the office shortly thereafter, and Jacob leaves because he thinks he knows why she's there, and he's probably right. She confronts Jorgen about not telling her that he's sick, and it's a very touching scene together where she tells him how important he is to her. Jacob calls the orphanage and tells Mrs. Shaw, the woman who's been running the orphanage with him, that he got the money, but he won't be coming back to India. Jorgen celebrates his 48th birthday with family, friends, and business associates. He talks about the bright future the corporation has with offices worldwide in the near future, and he invites everyone to the grand opening of their next international office just a few months hence. Helene looks at him, barely concealing the knowledge that he won't be at that opening. Anna and Jacob are also helping to keep up the brave facade. There's a party outside after the dinner, and we see everybody dancing with everybody else, including Jacob dancing with both Anna and Helene. Coincidentally, or perhaps not, the music we hear at first in the party is It's Raining Men. Sometime afterward, Jorgen is apparently sitting on the edge of his bed, having a bit of an existential crisis because it's a Scandinavian film. Helene comes into the room and asks him what's wrong. Jorgen finally breaks down and cries loudly, saying repeatedly he does not want to die. Cut to Jorgen's funeral. Many of the same people we saw at the birthday celebration are in attendance. As the graveside ceremony begins to wind down, we see Jacob consoling one of the twins. Helene takes special notice of this. Some time passes and we're back in India. We can see the construction is in progress on the orphanage. Jacob is here to visit and see how work is going, but he's more interested in seeing Pramod. They spend some time talking together, and Jacob invites Pramod to come with him and live in Denmark. However, Pramod declines, saying how nice everything is here in Mumbai now, and besides, didn't Jacob tell him how awful all the rich people are? Jacob then allows him to go outside and play soccer with his friends. He watches him through the window, and we leave him there to get a few scenes from around crowded, impoverished Mumbai as the credits begin to roll. And while there's nothing especially fun in the credits, I'll note this peculiarity. While the credits are in Danish, as they should be, when they get to the credits for the India unit, all of the job titles are marked off in English, which I found kind of curious. That's all.
So, Suzanne Beer, the director of this fine movie, and who also co-wrote the movie with Anders Thomas Jensen, she is arguably the most acclaimed filmmaker from Denmark working today, along with a Danish filmmaker who I'm not a big fan of, Lars von Trier. And there is a little bit of a history between the two of them, and I'll just say that you can Google it and let it go at that. But Beer first came to attention in this country with a movie she did called Brothers with Connie Nielsen and actor by the name of Ulrich Thompson, who's been in a bunch of stuff. Nielsen, you might remember as playing Joaquin Phoenix's sister in Gladiator. But in Brothers, she plays the widow of, or the supposed widow of, a soldier who is presumed dead. And she falls in love with his brother only for the presumed dead soldier to show up again. And the movie was remade in America some years later with Carey Mulligan playing Nielsen's role, and Jake Gyllenhaal played the brother. And after the and I wasn't crazy about Brothers, but After the Wedding was something else. Now, a lot of people like to dump on the Oscars, and one of the categories that they especially like to dump on is what used to be called Best Foreign Language Film, now called Best Non-English Language Film, for a lot of reasons. One of them, admittedly, is the fact that since so many movies these days are financed or get financing from several different countries, it's hard to tell what the official country is who can submit the movie. And so good movies get chucked by the wayside as a result. And then there's also the fact that each country nominates a movie to get chosen for Best Foreign Language Film. And if there's politics involved, or they want the safe, what's considered the safe choice, then again, some good movies get shunted by the wayside. But even most people who were skeptics of this category would say that the nominees for the Best Foreign Language Film in 2006 were of a high-quality group. You had The Lives of Others, the winner. A lot of people would choose Pan's Labyrinth. And then you have Days of Glory, a movie that, as I mentioned when we talked about Lives of Others, actually changed policy. We had Water, and we had After the Wedding, which, after I saw the movie, It was neck and neck, actually, with The Lives of Others as what was my favorite movie in that category. And while I liked Lives of Others a lot, and, you know, it's on my top 10 list for that year, and I also like Pan's Labyrinth, After the Wedding was a big surprise to me because this, as spoilerific as people are now, people were, or critics anyway, that were talking about After the Wedding were saying, you know, the less you know going in about this, the better. And that's very true. The fact that I didn't know anything going on about this other than it had Mads Mikkelsen in it, and it was made by the filmmaker of Brothers, and the fact that there was a dramatic moment that was going to happen after the wedding, you know, that's about all I knew going in. So I was blown away by this movie. How about you, Claude?
This was, I mean, geez, 2006, that was a strong field of contenders there. And it was, this is one of those times when it's truly a shame that there can be only one winner. But yeah, this was fantastic film. And you know what? Yeah, I like this one better than Lives of Others, frankly. I mean, we just talked about that one a couple of episodes ago. And as much as I liked that one, and I did like it, this one I liked a whole lot more. There's just so much more going on. The acting is better. And you've got it was hard to describe, so I didn't bring it up in the synopsis, but there are so many scenes where Beer chooses to do these extreme close-ups of people's eyes, and sometimes just one eye or their lips. And so you've got actors who have to act with like one piece of a body part instead of like their whole face or their whole body. And oh my God, do they manage to carry it off? They just did a fantastic, fantastic job. And I got to say, like, it's, you know, a special kudos to Sidse Knudsen, who played Helene. You know, she's just one of those actors who can just convey so much with just teeny tiny motions of her eye or her lip, or, you know, it was just, this movie knocked me out. It really did. I loved this film.
Okay. Well, I do prefer Lives of Others, but I do like this one a lot. And let's get back to those. I wasn't going to start with close-ups,
okay,
but we might as well talk about them since you brought them up. One thing that this movie has in common with Monsoon Wedding is that Beer and also her cinematographer here, Morten Søberg, use a handheld camera throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. And that includes the close-ups. It helps the handheld camera and the close-ups also lend themselves to the emotional currents of the story, in addition to the fact that they're allowing the actors to do a lot with very little. And in an interview on the DVD that I have, Beer said that she wanted it that way, that she wanted to have the camera work reflect all the emotions that were swirling around in the story. Now, what makes this movie of a piece with the rest of her filmography, which I'm sort of hit and miss on. There's one movie that she did, well, the first movie that she did in America, Things We Lost in the Fire, with Halle Berry and Benicio del Toro, that was also very good. And that also had a lot of close-ups and a lot of handheld work and some filtered shots, light filters, that is, to reflect the emotional currents of that story. And also took what may have been a schematic plot line and made it seem real instead of schematic, where I think Brothers does fall into the schematic part and also the movie that did win her the prize of Best Non-English Language Movie, In a Better World, even though I watched it again recently and it played better the second time that I watched it. But here, the idea that she tried to put forth in the movie, as well as other movies that she's made, of melodramas dealing with a moral issue or looking at the choices that people try to make for their lives or for other people's lives, especially when they believe that they're the ones making the moral choice, and as opposed to someone else, because you've got a whole lot of currents here in regards to that. You've got Jacob wanting to make the moral choice of staying in India because he prefers it there and because he thinks he's doing his best work there, only to be sent to Denmark. And then you've got Jorgen. On the one hand, he wants to make sure that his family is well taken care of after he dies. But on the other hand, he is playing God with Jacob's life and with other people's lives. And then you've got Helene making the choice of not telling Jacob about Anna and who she really is in relationship to Jacob. All these moral choices, or choices that the characters themselves thought were moral, all of them collide head on into this movie. And as I said, on the surface, that could seem very schematic, but the way it plays out feels natural and real.
Right. And as I said, like earlier about Monsoon Wedding, this is a film where most of your major characters start out one way and they evolve into something else. But in this particular case, it's not that they themselves are changing, is that our perception of them changes. And that's the difference here. Because with this one, like, it's almost as though some of these characters are slotting themselves into stereotypes, and it turns out not to be the case at all. And that was the thing that I found very interesting. It all comes down to, like, what were the motivations behind what they did and why did they do what they did? And as you say, like, they think they're making the morally correct choice, and maybe it even was, but it just didn't work out the way that any of them expected to. And so everybody is forced at one point or another in this film to make a very, very difficult choice in, you know, as the Jesuits say, what was the greater good of the situation. And it was just fascinating to me to watch, because you've got, let's say, you know, Jorgen, he's this rich guy, he's a billionaire, he's kind of pulling the strings and whatever else. And then it turns out that he's just very aware of his mortality. He wants to take care of his family. And when we see him, like, breaking down and crying a couple of times, the first time he does it, like, on the waterside with Jacob, and then later on when he is sitting in the bedroom and he just completely collapses and falls apart, and he's just, like, suddenly, like, hitting him so hard that this is going to happen, and it's going to happen soon. And, you know, once again, just as we had in Monsoon Wedding, you've got this strong father figure who's just suddenly coming completely unraveled, and you're really feeling for this guy that, you know, just a few minutes earlier you were saying, you know, what is this guy's evil plan that he's trying to hatch? And it's just wonderful the way we are pulled in to change our perceptions of each of these characters.
Right. Now, one thing that Beer mentioned in that interview on the DVD as well is that she wanted to be very careful that the movie wasn't getting too obvious about telegraphing what's really going on with the characters, because the DVD has some deleted scenes in there. One of them is Jorgen going on a fishing trip with his two young sons, with Helene, and during the trip, it's the deleted scene, remember?
Yeah, that's why.
And during this scene, he's getting sick. I mean, not in a way that's too obvious, but at the same time, Beer shot that. But when she was putting together the movie, she realized that she didn't want to give the game away. And so she cut that scene out so that we only gradually learn, just as with the characters, what's going on with what's really going on with Jorgen. And while sometimes that can lead to what I call ass backwards storytelling, in this case, it does seem like it fits and it does seem real, because you can sense when Jorgen is bringing Jacob here for the wedding and to meet the family, that he must have an ulterior agenda in mind. And so when you find out that he is dying, it feels logical. Oh, yeah, that's why he would want to do this, instead of feeling contrived.
Right. And just to be clear, like, Aline finds out that Jorgen is sick while he's away fishing with the twins. So right. Yeah, he goes away for the weekend with the twins to go fishing, and it's while he's gone that, you know, a lot of different elements happen, and she puts the pieces together and goes and finds the morphine and the other drug and calls the doctor. And so when he comes back, you know, that's when she confronts him about it, and he has to leave right away. And so, I would agree with that change, because it really does strike you a little bit harder when some of these pieces start falling into place that, okay, he's dying. We still don't know the whole picture yet, but he's dying, and that's got to be part of the calculus going on here, you know, and you still, he had been talking about, like, when he got drunk at the lunch meeting, he said something about, like, he paid for his, not at the lunch meeting, right before, where he had paid for his sins, you know, by putting this thing together. And so you're still wondering, like, what's his motivation at that point? Okay, we know he's dying, but is he basically doing this to, like, you know, is this like an indulgence for him? He's trying to buy his way into heaven or something like that. Still don't quite have the whole picture there, but it's like just starting to come into focus now.
Right. Now, there's a couple other pieces in the movie that Nair deals with that, if done the wrong way, could have come off as cliched or worse, patronizing, but she pulls them off pretty well. The first piece is the idea of the character who lived a wanton life in the past, being an alcoholic like Jacob was, or a heavy drinker anyway, and then trying to make up for it by living a selfless life, as Jacob is trying to do in his aid work. And that is a character we have seen many, 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 many times in movies. And if it doesn't come off, it plays as a complete cliche, but Beer and Mikkelsen, and I'm going to talk about Mikkelsen in a moment, they managed to pull it off here. And the other part that could come off as patronizing is something, the character that we talked about when we talked about Welcome to Sarajevo, and that is the aid worker working in a, if not a war zone, then a quote-unquote stereotypical undeveloped country. This is the image of India that people from India have accused Western filmmakers of exploiting if they ever make a movie set in India. You mentioned Slumdog Millionaire in the earlier part of the episode, and some of the criticism that was thrown against that movie was that people thought that Danny Boyle was making misery porn disguised as a Bollywood movie. And I can understand that argument, but I think in this movie, it comes off as honest, even though you've got another possibly cliched representation here in the relationship between Jacob and Pramod. Pramod, by the way, is played by a young actor by the name of Niral Mulchandani. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He comes off as very natural in the movie, and the two of them have a natural rapport together, which makes that whole relationship work instead of feeling patronizing or cliched.
Yeah, he does. And it's actually kind of a shame that young Niral, that's his only film credit right now. And you know, it's been a while, so he'd be a young adult at this point. But he seems to have done not much else, according to IMDb anyway. But yeah, I never really viewed Jacob as the, you know, alcoholic who, you know, cleaned himself up and tried to atone for his sins by doing all these wonderful things in India, probably because we get some exposition in the film that he had already been in India. He was there with Helene and she left. And so he was there. They were already doing some kind of work there. He started to drink heavily. He got himself cleaned up at some point and continued on with doing what he was doing. So it wasn't really like making up for all the bad things that he had done previously. He just like kind of got himself back on track with what he wanted to do. And unfortunately, you know, as the way the way Jorgen explains it is like, yeah, you've been trying for 20 years and, you know, it's like you're really not very good at it. You keep failing at this. And so I'm trying to give you the opportunity to be successful at it.
No, but he is trying to be a better person.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. But it's not as a means of like atoning for his previous sins. This is just like, you know, just a continuation of what he was doing previously. So, yeah, I'm a good person. Now I'm a good person who drinks. Now I'm a good person who's sober again and, you know, continuing to do my thing. And as a result, I might be a little bit better at it now because, you know, as it was explained, there were like several different things that he had tried, all of which had failed. But we also have that he has been working with this orphanage for 8 years, which is a nice chunk out of the 20. So he must be, you know, finally getting some traction underneath him, even if the orphanage itself is running out of money.
Right. But I think I'm thinking again of In a Better World, mm-hmm. which if you've not seen it, it's about these two boys. One of them is a boy who's bullied constantly in school. Another one is a new transfer to school who's had a huge chip on his shoulder ever since his mother died, and he feels that it's his father's fault, and he doesn't like talking to anybody, but he sort of takes pity on the kid being bullied, and I'm not going to get into that too much, but the kid being bullied, his father works as a doctor in Africa. And while I understand Beer's larger point in having him as a character like that, because the reason why the father doesn't encourage his son to fight back against the bullies the way this other kid does, because he's seen too much of what happens while he's been in Africa when people use violence to try and solve things, and he has to deal with the consequences every day. While all of that is understandable, in that movie, it does come off as somewhat schematic and patronizing, whereas in this movie, it's handled better.
Right. No, no argument there. I mean, this is definitely a situation where, you know, in a lot of these different scenarios that are going on throughout this film, there's no good guy and there's no bad guy. It's just everybody trying to do their best. And unfortunately, the best just ain't good enough in some cases. And so everybody's acting out of a certain, you know, acting from their moral compass. And while they might have been probably correct in the moment, it doesn't always work out for the bigger picture.
Right. Now, let's talk about Mads Mikkelsen for a moment, because he is the, at least to audiences in the U.S., the most recognizable member of the cast. He had first made waves the previous year by playing the villain in the reboot of Casino Royale, mm-hmm. and he made quite an impression in that movie. And he's played, although he has played heroic characters, like in the Star Wars movie that he appeared in, he played someone who ultimately was a good guy. His most memorable characters basically have been either wanton characters, like in a couple of the movies he's done with Thomas Vinterberg, or villains, such as the character he played in Casino Royale, and then, of course, most memorably, as Hannibal Lecter in the short-lived TV series version of Hannibal, which I have not seen, but the clips I've seen of him suggest that he brings something memorable to the part. But while he's mostly known for playing villains or one-time characters, he shows here, and he also showed in that Star Wars movie that I mentioned, even though I think it was
Rogue One.
Okay, Rogue One, yes. Even though I am not a big fan of that movie, I thought he was one of the better things about it. And he is very good.
Kind of a low bar, though.
He is, well, I mean, you also have Donnie Yen getting to do his stuff in it. So it's not like he's the only standout in the movie.
No.
But anyway, Mikkelsen shows here that he can play someone who is at heart a decent guy and yet not make him boring at all. You know, you've got all these undercurrents from the past that are helping in his performance, but he plays the character very simply, and it's all the better for that.
Yeah, and he's not unwilling to let you know how he's feeling. So when we get the reveal during the wedding reception about what's going on, and he starts to figure out what's happening, and he's looking at Helene, and he's looking at Anna, and he's looking at Helene, and Helene's giving him nothing. She's looking right at him, but she's not saying, yeah, it's what you think it is. You know, you can see he's putting it together, and there's not much change in his expression, but you also see like a tear running down his left cheek. And so that the woman who's next to him and flirting with him like incessantly doesn't see that he's crying, but in fact he is. So she doesn't really know why he walked out. And I didn't bring this up in the synopsis, and she tries to follow him out, and he has to like yell at her to make her go away. And so he's allowing himself to have these tender moments. And there's another one that struck me. And I say two because it's really the same thing, but they're related, is when Anna shows up at his hotel room after she discovers Christian's infidelity. Okay. And she starts to tell him what's going on. And of course, we don't hear any. There's no dialogue here. It's just like flashing back and forth between the hotel room and what she saw. He reaches up and he puts his hand on her cheek to just, you know, let her know I'm here. It's okay. That kind of thing. And then what happens is the next morning, All right, they're having breakfast. Helene shows up, and Anna volunteers to go get some breakfast for Helene. She walks out. The two of them start talking about things, and again, he reaches up, and he puts his hand on Helene's cheek. But the thing that struck me was he put it on the other cheek, which I thought was just kind of interesting. So in the hotel, he's on Anna's right cheek. In the hotel lobby, he's on Helene's left cheek. And I just thought, wow, that's interesting. It's just like the same gesture, but it, like on opposite sides, one side for the mother, one side for the daughter. And I thought that was just a neat decision that was made in that particular instance there, that here's this guy showing this act of tenderness, but he's giving it to the different family members in different ways.
And that's a tie-in, believe it or not, to Monsoon Wedding, because Beer, while she and Anders Jensen did write the script together, she also allowed the actors to improvise. Mm-hmm. And I think that included not just the dialogue, but also the physical moments. And I believe Beer mentioned that was that cheek touching in both scenes was improvised by the actors in the scene. And while you brought up the actress who played Helene as doing an excellent job, I also want to spotlight Ralph Lasgard, who plays Jorgen, mm-hmm. So well. Because, you know, although he gives a very over-the-top performance because his character is basically trying to keep everything joyful so that no one will be able to sense what's really going on inside him, he does give you those undercurrents as well. But also, I feel that Stein Fisher Christensen, who's younger than the other three principals, she holds her own with everybody here and does a remarkable job, especially in the scenes that she has with Mikkelsen, both when they're first talking with each other after they've discovered the truth, mm-hmm. and then when she's telling him about Christian, who, by the way, is played by an actor named Christian Taldrup. But both of those scenes, Christensen handles very well.
She does. And, you know, I know I did this in the last episode, but I'm going to do it again here. She gives off an Emily Mortimer vibe in this particular film. And she does. I can see that. Yeah, she does. She does a really good job with it. And she, again, like Sidse Knudsen, who plays her mother, she does a very good job of just conveying with her face a lot of what's going on. As I said, the scene where she's telling Jacob what happened with Christian, we don't hear anything, okay? It just keeps cutting back and forth between the flashback to what she saw and the two of them just looking at each other. And we still have a deep understanding of, like, yes, she is telling him that this is what's happening, but it's not as though we come back to see the two of them and her lips are moving or whatever. It's just a very quiet, very tender kind of moment. And I'll give you the other one is later in the film when she confronts her father about, you know, why didn't you tell me that you're sick, that you're dying, because I need these opportunities to say these important things to you. And again, you really, really feel for her and him in that scene as well.
Right. Now, one last thing I want to bring up before we wrap this up. Mm-hmm. This was almost remade back in 2009. Michael Caton Jones, who's directed such films as Scandal, Rob Roy, and This Boy's Life, was going to direct. And Tom Wilkinson was going to play the part of Jorgen. And Camilla Bella, I believe, was going to play Anna, but the financing fell through. Instead, what we got was a 2019 remake of the movie. This one was directed by Bart Freundlich, and Julianne Moore plays the Jorgen role. Here she's called Teresa, and Michelle Williams plays the Jacob role. And of course, the genders get flipped with Helene as well. She's called Oscar here and is played by Billy Crudup. But again, it's a daughter, and she's played in the remake by Abby Quinn, and her character's name is Grace. But sadly, despite the cast, and that is quite a good cast there among the three principals anyway, this makes almost all of the mistakes that the original version avoided.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about that, because I did read the synopsis. I looked at that and I was like, wow, this is a pretty good cast, like as you said. And then I started to read a synopsis and I was like, wow, they're really kind of torturing some elements of the story to make this gender flip work the way it's got to work. And also just, you know, something as simple as instead of having to go to somewhere in Europe, they go to New York City. And I really feel that kind of sucked away some of the overall specialness of this story. And I was going to ask you, I was like, is this any good despite what I'm reading here? And you're saying not so much.
You know, while we have talked about that, there are some English language remakes that are worth watching, even if they're not as good as the original non-English language movie. In this case,
ain't one of them.
No. Okay. You got to stick with the original Danish version here. So, Claude, do you have anything that you want to add before we wrap this up?
This film was robbed at the Oscars. This film was robbed.
You say potato.
Okay.
This is the part where we tell you that both of these movies, After the Wedding and Monsoon Wedding, are available on DVD. Monsoon Wedding, as I mentioned, is available on Criterion DVD, a two-disc edition, which also includes some of the documentaries, both documentary shorts mostly, and also fiction shorts that Nair has made throughout her career. And After the Wedding is available just on a regular DVD, but if you prefer to watch both or either of them online, while Monsoon Wedding is readily available to rent or buy from Amazon, Apple TV, DirecTV, Google Play, and most of the other usual suspects as far as streaming services go. Whereas After the Wedding is available to stream if you subscribe to DirecTV or through AMC. You can stream through AMC Plus if you subscribe on that through Amazon or the Roku channel, or you can just rent or buy it from Amazon or Apple TV.
And what's happening next time around?
Next episode, well, in this episode, we talked about movies directed by women. Next episode, we're going to talk about two movies that are centering on women. Mm. They are from Japan, from 1960, though released in the U.S. in 1963, When a Woman Ascends the Stairs, directed by Mikio Naruse, and from Spain, from 1988, Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, written and directed by Pedro Almodovar. And both of them are available on Criterion DVD. Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown also has a regular DVD floating around. But if you prefer to stream, When a Woman Ascends the Stairs is available to stream exclusively through the Criterion channel, Whereas Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, you can stream for free on Freevee if you're willing to put up with the ads. Or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, AMC On Demand, or DirecTV. Although I won't swear whether any of those streaming services has the movie subtitled. But at any
also worth
rate,
noting, Freevee used to be IMDb TV. They changed. Yes. They changed names, and so just in my experience, the time that I have used at least IMDb TV, they are pretty good about like stopping at a fairly decent breakpoint, doing the ad, and coming back exactly where they left off. You don't lose anything by watching the ads, except a minute or two.
Yes. So this is also the point where we tell you that if you have a question or comment, you can either leave it on the posts on our website, wordsandmovies.com, or you can email us. Our email address is wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com, or you can make a comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And I am also found on Facebook under my name, Sean Gallagher. And Claude, how about you?
I am also on the Book of Face under my own name, Claude Call. And you can check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, pop music podcast at howgooditis.com and in your favorite podcatcher.
All right. So thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much. And Rebecca, please take us away.
This is your announcer, Rebecca Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Mophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Anchor.fm. If you want to support the show, go to anchor.fm/wordsandmovies and click on the support link. Who knows? Maybe they'll even kick a few bucks my way. Thanks for listening.